Welcome to today's colloquium. Today's speaker is David Torrey. David did his PhD at Case Western Reserve University. Then did postdocs in Nijmegen and the National Research Council and Naval Research Labs in Washington, D.C. But then he spent 2 years in industry as the Director of Research and Development at Brooker Instruments. Then he took a position at MIT for 15 years. Then last year he arrived in Waterloo with 4,000 boxes of experimental equipment. And he's setting up a laboratory here. You can imagine it's quite a big laboratory. So he's at IQC and also in the Department of Chemistry at the University of Waterloo. And he's also an associate at Perimeter Institute, if you look at the front page. On the Perimeter Institute website, you'll see an article on that. Today, he's going to speak on from quantum parlatrics to quantum computers.
Thank you very much. So it's fun to be here. It's always fun to talk to the local crowd.
And I'm going to give you a talk that's a little bit different than what I've been talking about recently. I want to tell you why the lab we're setting up at IQC has the structure it does, and how all of these many different experiments that go on in the lab can hopefully come together to lead us to a device which will be a little bit closer to a quantum computer. So we're going to talk about that. We're funded. Everyone's funded. So 1995 or 96, Tim Havel came over to my lab at MIT. And Tim asked me, could we use NMR to build a quantum computer? And we fought over it for quite a while. That's his style, if you know him. And the answer was surely that we could use NMR to explore quantum dynamics, but it would, in my term, be quantum parlor tricks, that we would do little things, we would know what the result was beforehand, and we wouldn't surprise anyone. And we still started off doing a few of these quantum parlor tricks. And then with Manik Kanil and Raymond Laflamme, we started looking at quantum error correction. And I was surprised that with quantum error correction, we didn't find quantum error correction, but we found in quantum error correction a nice piece of physics which was not anticipated directly in physics, in experimental physics. That there were things in quantum error correction that you couldn't go back and find in Felix Bloch's papers. And, you know, the fundamental physics was all there, but the appropriate way of thinking about it was not there. And so we, then we started to think that, yes, actually, there's more reason to explore quantum information processing, and that quantum information processing gives us a better perspective on experimental physics and allows us to do things which we wouldn't have thought of otherwise. And we've used it to look at quantum codes, process tomography, random unitary. So what we decided was that NMR was a good testbed for looking at quantum parlor tricks involving many aspects that you would need to understand if you're going to build a quantum computer. And we spent some time doing that. NMR is still the best testbed for looking at quantum information processing. I want to show you this slide to give you some idea of how efficiently you can use NMR to explore ideas of quantum information processing. So, it's a timeline of undergraduates who spend 10 weeks in the lab over a summer at MIT, my lab, and they would do an experiment. And in 10 weeks, they would understand a piece of physics, they would reduce it to an NMR experiment, they would redo the NMR experiment, and then sometime over the next some years following it, that it would actually get written up and published. And they did some very sophisticated experiments, some entanglement swapping, random walks, more entanglement GHZ states. Most of these undergraduates continued to work in quantum information processing. It's been going on for so long that the first student, Jeff Gore, is now a faculty member in physics at MIT. And I want to show you the last piece that we did at MIT. So the last was, again, a summer experiment with Brian Pepper and Natalia Antler to look at transport. What they did was to take a 1D chain of spins in the lab, and they looked at transport under two models of close coupling. One, the so-called XY model, and another, the double quantum filtered. And what I've plotted here are simulations of time versus the Z components of the state. And the state that they start with is the first spin in the chain polarized, and all the other spins in the identity state. You can see nicely that under these two Hamiltonians, you get a beautiful transport. And once you've hit the boundary of the number of spins, then you see interference effects as the information is reflected from that boundary. Okay? They did the experiment. And I'm not going to fully explain the experiment to you, but if I have a 1D set of spins, and they have nearest neighbor interactions, then you know that there's a fermionic model for that. And the fermionic model, of course, is a classical model. if there's next nearest neighbor couplings, and here, this is a dipolar coupled system, so there's certainly next nearest neighbor coupling, then the fermionic approximation breaks down. And you can support interference effects. These two signatures, the so-called zero quantum, double quantum oscillations, are exactly the fermionic piece. This growth of the four quantum, of four spin coherence, a correlation between four particles, this is a signature that you've moved outside of the fermionics. So here in the lab, in a short period of time, the students could explore quantum information processing, what I think is a very sophisticated system on 19 spins. I don't call them qubits, there's 19 spins. But that's a big Hilbert space, would be hard to explore in any other way. So it's still a good test bed. We can do an awful lot with it. We've done a lot with it. And so one could ask the question, have we learned enough from all these quantum parlor tricks to build a quantum computer? And unfortunately, the answer for me is no, I haven't. Now Dan probably has, but he knew it beforehand. But I haven't learned enough. But perhaps I've learned enough to suggest to you a next generation of device that's going to have many of the features we would like of a quantum computer. So that's what I'm going to try to show you, is how we're going to build at RAC 2, a prototype quantum computer that will have the features we would like. So where are we right now? Right now, we're sitting here, and we have, you know, nice systems. There are many, many, many examples of physical systems with one qubit. You know, there are a few with a few qubits. We really know optimal control well. We know error correction. We know how to do error detection. What don't we know? We don't know how to efficiently get rid of entropy in any system. That's hard. We know nothing about scaling, I will say. I'm going to skip the other two. So what I want to do is, in building this next set of a quantum information processor, is I want to be able to do parallel operations. Okay, that's important. If you want to do error correction, you need to be able to do that in parallel. So I want to make that right up front. I want to be able to do parallel operations on my quantum computer. I need to know the noise source, because we want to control it. I want to have good control. And I want to have some efficient means of removing entropy. And if I could do this, I could answer questions which we can't answer today in NMR. And so it would take us a step further to having a quantum computer. So here's what it looks like. And let me walk you through this. We've got a bunch of local processors. So think about these pieces as local processors. So I show you three local processors here. Each of the local processors has at its core an electron spin. And the electron spin is going to be our actuator. Everything that we do in the local processor is mediated by this electron spin. The quantum processor, sitting out here in the nuclear spins, is going to have a long lifetime. The nuclear spins are very coherent. They will have a fast gate because we'll do everything in the nuclear spins via the electron spin. All of our control is going to be via the hyperfine interaction to the electron spin. Okay, so we'll have very fast gates over the nuclear spins. Since I have this array of processors, I need to couple to them. They need to be coupled to each other, sorry. And so I'm going to introduce a quantum channel that will allow me to have very efficient exchange of information between quantum processors. I didn't say, but I should have. Since we have these small quantum processors, they're all exactly the same. And so I can have error correction in the local processors in parallel. I'm going to apply microwave fields to control the electron spins. The electron spins provide control over the whole processor. And I can do that in parallel to all of the gates at once, to all of the processors at once. I need to know that this processor is different than that processor. It's different than that processor. And so I reserve for myself a couple of nuclear spins that I'm going to put in as classical bits, not qubits. I want to be able to use these bits as labels of the local processor. The reason I want them to be bits is the T1 in this system is very, very long. Think hours to days. And so we say, fine, I can set these up and life will be good. They will remember unless I muck them up by my control sequences. But, you know, given short of me doing something bad, they'll behave properly. And finally, I need to remove some information or I need to remove some entropy. And so I have some other electron spin out here, which I'm going to couple either by optics or transport or to a cavity. I'm going to have an electron spin that I can efficiently measure. And so the way you want to think about this is that this piece is one molecule, okay? Not an ensemble of molecules. We're going to have a system where there's a single quantum system we're looking at and we'll detect it. So I want to build this. I'm not going to be able to build this right off. I can build this piece of it, we've already built. We can store this piece of it. We're trying to do that right now. This piece of it we already have. I'm going to take little pieces. So right now in the lab, what I'm doing, or my students are doing, I'm not doing anything, is to look at the local pieces of this, to break this down and say, what's the physics I need here? What's the physics I need there? I'm going to walk you through that. And that's why we have such a complicated lab. Because I say, I still need that liquid state NMR. Need a liquid state NMR because there are questions here of control. I need to develop the control. It's much easier to develop the control on liquid state NMR where you have long coherences than it is in the solid state. I need solid state NMR because, in fact, we're going to get to the solid state. That's where we're thinking our processor lives. So we certainly need that. We need to have an efficient control and exchange of information between electron and nuclear spins. So we get a bunch of things like that. And then we need to have detection schemes. And I don't know what the best detection scheme is. It's very simple to say, it should be optics, or it should be transport, or it should be a cavity. You know, we can do all of those in the lab. And none of them does everything we want. And so right now what we do is we investigate them all and try to learn how to get the best from each. And we'll figure out where we're going. So let's see how it all comes together. So there's our model again. What I want to start with is I want to start with one of these local processors. So I'm going to be concrete now and go through the physics. So we're going to look at how do we use an electron spin as an actuator to control nuclear spins. Okay, and the reason we want to do this is we've said before, you know, nuclear spins are great qubits. They're coherent, they're long-lived, but they're slow. If I rely upon the dipole-dipole interaction to have control over nuclear spins, my clock speed is kilohertz. No one wants to wait around for a slow quantum computer. Okay, so what we're going to have to do is speed that up. The hyperfine interaction is as strong as hundreds of megahertz. Okay, so if I can replace the dipole interaction with the hyperfine interaction, life will be good. The other thing, of course, is that I can't detect a single nuclear spin. I can detect a single electron spin. I can use that to infer a single nuclear spin. But I can't directly, no one can detect a single nuclear spin. But we can detect single electron spins. Okay, so here's the system that we're using. We have an electron hyperfine, an electron Zeeman term, which just says we've applied a big magnetic field and the electron spin is a spin 1/2 particle and it's polarized in the magnetic field. Nothing surprising here. We have the same thing for the Zeeman interaction, except the Zeeman interaction is 1,000 times smaller than the electron interaction. And so, hey, this one we can use. It has some energy. This is, you know, a small little thing that comes along for the ride. We have the hyperfine interaction, and there's two terms in the hyperfine interaction. There's a Fermi contact term, which is a through bond term, and there's a dipole-dipole effect, the through space interaction. The hyperfine interaction, all it says is that, look, I've got one spin over here, which is an electron. I've got a little nuclear spin over here, and they feel a magnetic-magnetic interaction. It's nothing more complicated than that. Now, what I'm going to do is we're going to take the system And we're going to arrange that the magnetic field that we use is strong for the electron spin and weak for the nuclear spin. Okay? So the way you want to think about this is that the electron spin, SZ, is a good quantum number. The Zeeman interaction of the electron spin is the dominant interaction here. That's setting our energy scale. The Zeeman interaction of the nuclear spin, that's small. It competes with the hyperfine. I've just written out the hyperfine to show you the structure. That remember, SZ is a good quantum number, so I have to keep the hyperfine terms with SZ. IZ, the nuclear spin angular momentum operator, that is not a good quantum number. So the nuclear spin is quantized in the sum of the hyperfine interaction and the Zeeman interaction. Okay, so if you look at the energy level diagrams, we get the electron Zeeman, the nuclear Zeeman. So now we have a four-dimensional space. And then the hyperfine interaction shifts the levels. Because we have this nice term sitting out over here, which is the anisotropic part of the hyperfine interaction, then the selection rules change, right? For the electron spin, the selection rule is really easy. The electron spin has to flip. But for the nuclear spin, remember, SC was not a good quantum number. So all of the transitions involving the electron spin flipping, but the nuclear spin changing anything, are allowed. Okay, so now we have universal control, because everything is allowed in this nice diagram. And the way I want you to think about this is that the nuclear spin, remember, we're trying to have control over the nuclear spin. And for now, the nuclear spin is just the spin one-half particle. If I say I want universal control, that means I should be able to take any the nuclear spin, I should be able to rotate it in any direction. Okay? How do I do that? Well, that's easy. If the electron spin is pointing up, then the nuclear spin sees some local field. It sees the local field, which is the Zeeman field plus the hyperfine field of the electron spin. If the electron spin's pointing down, the nuclear spin sees some other local field. Again, a sum of the Zeeman and of the hyperfine, except the hyperfine has these two components, x and y. And so if I rotate about this direction for a while, and I rotate about some other unrelated direction for a while, I can go anywhere on the Bloch sphere. So you have universal control over one particle. It turns out that we have universal control over any number of nuclear spins, provided that the hyperfine interactions have no symmetry, right? So that's a requirement for this program, that we have one electron spin surrounded by a set of nuclear spins. There's a set of hyperfine interactions. They have some random structure given by the chemistry of the system. And as long as there's no symmetries in that, we can have universal control over the full nuclear Hilbert space just by modulating the electron spin. I never have to address the nuclear spins at all. It has a lot of nice features. One, it says, take this big console that we have for controlling the nuclear spins and just get it out of the lab. All we needed was that one electron spin, okay, into microwave electronics. All right. So, to say we have universal control, all that says really is that, look, I can take in this four-level diagram, remember that we have the electron spin manifold here, spin up, electron spin manifold spin down. Remember our model. The model says that the electron spin is not a qubit. It's our instrument. The nuclear spin is a qubit. So we're going to live in this manifold. Okay, but I'm going to use the electron spin transitions to control motion in this manifold. Right? So if I want to have a 90-degree pulse between these two levels, that's okay. I can do that. But I'm going to send the electron spin up here, and I'm going to bring it back down. Right? So you can calculate what the shape of the pulses are. We could spend a lecture talking about that, but it's easy to do. You can do it well. It works well. Troy would have noticed that I skipped over his spectrometer there. I apologize. It's a beautiful spectrometer. but we're going to talk about right now looking at the nuclear spin. So what I want to do, just to convince you that we really do have this control, is I want to measure a Ramsey experiment of the nuclear spin. So I'm going to take the nuclear spin. The nuclear spin initially does not have any polarization. So the electron spin has polarization. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to take polarization from the electron spin, we're going to swap that to the nuclear spin. After I do that, I'm going to use the electron spin to rotate the nuclear spin by 90 degrees. And then we're going to allow it to process. So we're going to create a coherence between these two levels, these two nuclear spin levels. We'll allow the spin to process for some variable time. Then we'll rotate it back. We'll give another 90 degrees, just put it on a quantization axis. We'll do another swap to take the information from the nuclear spin back to the electron spin. Then we'll read out the state of the electron spin. Okay, so the electron spin becomes our full console. The nuclear spin is just the qubit. The electron spin is a spectrometer. And here we show you, if I looked at the nuclear spin for a particular pulse, what does the trajectory look like of the nuclear spin? That looks like a mess. But who cares? The starting point and the end point are exactly where they should be, right? In between, okay, does some wild things. But, when we do the Ramsey experiment, so here we're looking at time versus the oscillation, the Ramsey frequency of the electron, of the nuclear spin, sorry. And you see nicely that it oscillates as it should, that we can do this experiment with high precision. It is perhaps surprising, but it shouldn't be, that if we have more and more and more of nuclear spins, we still have universal control. It doesn't matter how many spins we have. And so in particular, if I have a proton and a carbon and I want to do a controlled NOT gate between them, well, this would do it, using the electron spin. And there's no reason you should recognize that as a control knot, but you can take my word that it has high fidelity, and we can even implement it and it would work. Okay, so that's the electron spin actuator. That says that locally, yeah, oh, is there a question? Yeah.
Just a dumb question. Do you mean you can have one electron spin control an arbitrary number of nuclear spins?
Yes.
So that the qubit Hilbert space of the electron spin is controlling an n qubit Hilbert space of big 2 to the n?
That's right.
Okay, you didn't explain that.
Yes, that's what I mean.
Okay.
Good.
Are you going to come back and explain how?
No, I'm not going to. I'm not going to explain that, hey, this actually does work. I'm going to tell you that it does work, and it is easy to see. If you want to see it, of course, what do? Take our control operators, you take the internal Hamiltonian, you look at all the commutators, and you show that they form a complete algebra over the nuclear Hilbert space. We've done that. It's published. It's true.
Okay.
Okay. So now we have our little processor, local processor. It says, hey, here we have an actuator. Here we have a set of qubits. We can use those qubits as a local processor. Now, the next step I want to look at is just these two bits. And this isn't, there's no difference to this than what we've done before, right? I mean, these are spins. The only difference is instead of initializing them through the electron in some complicated state, I'm going to initialize them in a very simple state. I'm going to initialize them as either spin up or spin down in their basis when the electron spin is polarized. Okay, that's all we're going to do. And the only thing I need to tell you is, how do I differentiate this processor from that processor from that processor in the lab? And we do that by applying a magnetic field gradient. That's what this piece here is supposed to show, that we have a magnetic field gradient. And so that this piece is when this gradient is on, this is a pulse gradient, this is in a stronger magnetic field than this one, than this one. And experimentally, we can create a gradient which is 100,000 hertz per nanometer for the electron spin. And that is strong enough. Okay? Kevin back there, he's going to do that. But that's strong enough, we'll have control. So let's talk about something that's more challenging to look at. What I thought the challenging piece was right here, how to effectively couple those two processors. Because if I couple those two processors, it's very tempting to say, let's take the information from the nuclear spin to the electron spin, and then take it to that electron spin, and then take it to the nuclear spin. And if you do that, you're going to lose all your information, because the nuclear spins are great qubits. But the electron spins are great actuators, but they're lousy qubits. You want to keep putting them back in the zero state. You don't want to have information. You don't want coherence sitting out here. And if I have to send information one qubit at a time through there, the information is going to be residing on those electron spins for too long. There's going to be errors. I'm going to have to apply error correction. And life is going to get to be a drag. Well, that's okay, because Troy and Chris said, hey, they can solve that problem. So here's how it works. What we're going to do is we're going to couple two of these local processors via a dipole-dipole interaction of the electron spin so that this arrow here says that, yes, there's a magnetic dipole-dipole coupling that shifts the energies of these two electron spins so they know each other exists. I'm going to use that interaction to create a channel where this spin is coupled to this spin via an effective dipolar interaction mediated by these electron spins, but the information will never reside on those electron spins. Okay, never within some epsilon. The epsilon will be small. It's not a problem. So let's see how it works. So here's the picture rotated on side. We've got the electron spins. We've got the nuclear spins. Remember what we've said. This local processor is exactly the same as that local processor, right? So this hyperfine field is exactly the same as that hyperfine field. And this one, of course, is exactly the same as that, etc. This spin, if I write down the Hamiltonians, there they are. There is no coupling term. There's no term that directly couples this spin to that spin. What we have is the electron Zeeman term, the nuclear Zeeman term, the hyperfine terms, just the same terms we were using before, and this additional term, which is the dipolar term between the two electrons. And now I want to take a simple piece of this to convince you. I'm going to take one nuclear spin, one electron spin, one nuclear spin, one electron spin. So just a four-spin piece, just so we can see the physics. So if I take that four-spin piece, the most interesting, the most revealing aspect of this is to look at the commutator between the dipole and the two hyperfines. Okay? So I want to look at that this nested commutator between the dipole and the two hyperfines. And what I'm going to do is to rely upon a microwave field to drive the system and look in the interaction frame of that. But it gets a little bit complicated. I'm going to come back to this slide. But let's look here. I've got two nuclear spins, so it's a four-level system. But I've got two electron spins, so the electron spins are labeling those. And so I have one four-level nuclear manifold for the two electron spins pointing up. I've got one four-level nuclear manifold for one electron up, one down, and for one down, one up, right? And there's some higher levels, but I don't care about them. I only care about this. Remember that we want the electron spin to be polarized. This is our computer right here, okay? But we're going to use the rest of the space, just like we did in the local processor, to allow us to have control. That's okay. So now, if I look at that coupling between the dipolar interaction between the two electron spins and the corresponding hyperfine terms, then we see that there are transitions that are allowed that connect this level to this level and that level to that level. Well, what I want to do is down here in this manifold, I want to apply a swap gate. I want to take the up-down nuclear spin to the down-up nuclear spin, right? This would be equivalently the down, the up-up, and that's the down-down, right? So the swap gate says, oh yeah, connect these two levels. Okay, this Hamiltonian doesn't do that. But I can apply a microwave field that connects these transitions. These are allowed transitions. So the blue lines are what I'm driving with my microwave field. If I drive those with the microwave field, you can see what happens. If I drive up here, then the second commutator of the dipole and hyperfine fields allows me to move over here. And now if I'm clever, or if my students are clever and they share it with me, then we can end up back over here. And we can create a coherence, or in fact carry out a swap between these two operators. And if I go into the interaction frame of the microwave field and I look at the total Hamiltonian, I back up here, then I get this nice alphabet of an effective Hamiltonian. The effective Hamiltonian relies not at all on the electron spin. It gives me directly a dipole-dipole interaction between the two nuclear spins. So now by moving into an interaction frame, I effectively couple the two nuclear spins that were not coupled before. Okay? And I do that with the strength of the dipole frequency of the coupling the two electron spins. So not with a nuclear dipole frequency, but with an electron frequency. I speed things up incredibly. The nice thing is that if I go to that frame, I couple this spin to that spin, I couple this spin to that spin, I couple this spin to that spin. So we have what I would refer to as a wide quantum channel. All of the spins in one node are effectively coupled to their partner, so the spin in the second node that has the same hyperfine terms. Okay? And we have universal control, so we could do more interesting things. But, you know, let's just take that for a second. I can do a square root of swap between the nodes. I can do it in parallel. I can do it efficiently. I can do it fast. And you can say, have you actually done it? And no. But we will. That's what we're building. And so Chris gave me this slide yesterday. This shows the fidelity of carrying out that model swap versus the parameter, the figure of merit, the decoherence parameter. The decoherence parameter here goes as 1 over the electron T1 times 1 over the dipolar frequency. Okay, so that makes sense. You have a relaxation times the frequency, and it's 1 over that. And so we have our scale in the horizontal axis, which if you're going to the right says, hey, the T1's getting shorter, things are getting worse, or your dipolar frequency is getting shorter, things are getting harder as you go that way. But hey, our devices are over here. Okay, so we have good fidelity on paper. Any moment now, they'll show me we have good fidelity on this oscilloscope. Now, it's this wide quantum channel says that the nuclear spins with the same hyperfines are coupled from this node to this node. Now, of course, if you're not careful how you do this, you can connect this nuclear spin to that one, or you know, that one to that one. And we know how to control that. What you need to do is you need to have the dipole frequency to be the smallest frequency. So the electron dipole frequency needs to be smaller than the hyperfine frequencies. And if you do that, then you can have this nice model of parallel control. So you can see that eventually it has to run out, right? Because you're saying that there has to be this separation. Now, optimal control theory should allow us to look at more general solutions, but that's the solution we have today. So what can we do? We can build a small local processor. We can build a few of them. We can couple them together. so we can start to build up something that looks like a quantum computer. Remember, when the quantum computer is running, these blue bits are set to a fiducial state. This magnetic field gradient is turned off. And so we can do parallel operations that treat all of the local processors exactly the same. We can run error correction in parallel over all those local processors. So now we need to worry about, what are we correcting against? And what we're correcting against is what we engineered into the system. We're correcting against that electron, right? What's decohering the nuclear spins? This electron that we placed there. So what I want to do is to use the electron as an actuator to write a quantum code over the nuclear spins and to arrange that code to protect the nuclear spins from the electron T1, which is the source of our control. Okay? So that's what we're going to do. So we're looking at this little piece of it now. But now remember that here, in addition to being an actuator, the same identical nuclear spin is a source of noise. I want to remind you, probably not reminding anyone in this audience, I stole the slide from another talk. Forget about reminding. I want to tell you about self-decoupling. Imagine you have two spins, and they talk to each other. And I look at the expectation value of sigma x for one of them, the coupling is sigma z, sigma z. Then what I'll see is this set of beats. And the beat says, yeah, the coherence is moving between the two spins. It's oscillating between them. And as I change the T1 of the second system, so I'm looking at system I, I'm changing the T1 of system S. As I change the T1, well, what you see exactly what you expect. As you reduce T1, then initially you lose information, right? That you decohere the system. So T1 is just a depolarizing channel in this model. But if I make T1 really, really short, then, of course, what spectroscopists call self-decouple, I protect the I spin from the S spin, because the S spin is fluctuating so quickly that the I spin doesn't even know it's there, okay? And that's why you have this transition, that once the T1 is shorter than 1 over the coupling strength, then as you make T1 shorter and shorter, actually, the coherence lengthens in time. Okay? That's the sort of idea I want to use. But now, remember, we have the T1 of the electron spin is what's going to be causing this, and the electron spin is the control element. Okay, so I just said that. And let me reiterate a piece here. Here I show you the nuclear spin level, the nuclear spin manifold for two nuclear spins. And up here, the same thing, of course, just labeled by the electron spin, which in this case is the first label. The nuclear spin quantization axis is different in this manifold than in this manifold. So when an electron spin flips, you have the quantization axis of the nuclear spin going to some random place for some random period of time. So the electron spin flip is both a T1 and a T2 process for the nuclear spin. So if we want to code against it, we need to code the nuclear spins for noise about any axis. The good thing is that all of the nuclear spins see the same electron. So if nuclear spin 1 sees an electron spin flip, the nuclear spin 2 sees exactly the same flip. Yeah? Okay. So we're going to use that. And the code we're going to run is a noiseless subsystem code. So it's a well-known code to protect against collective noise about any axis. And the way it works is you compose it, the code, you store your information in how you compose the code words. So if I take three nuclear spins, 3 to the 1/2 particles, I can create one logical qubit. And so I start off here, I've just plotted the total angular momentum, and here the number of spin one half particles. So if I have one spin one half particle, I have a spin one half particle. If I have two spin one half particles, then I can describe it, some piece of it as a particle with zero spin and some piece of it as a particle with spin one. And if I have three spin one half particles, then there's some piece of it which has a total spin angular momentum of one half, and there's some piece that has a total spin angular momentum of three halves. The information is stored in how I compose the spin one half state. Okay? And so I have, you know, the probabilities of going in these two and the phase between them. So that's how I'm going to compose this. And notice what happens in these decoherence free subspace, this noiseless subsystem, is that I always have this additional spin one half degree of freedom that is carried along for the ride. So the information that I store, which is going to be in the amplitudes and phases inside here, that's protected. This piece of the Hilbert space will actually evolve, but it'll evolve in a very nice way. It'll evolve in a way that's separable, and I can recover my information even though this piece evolves. Come on. I'm going to skip that because we're going to run out of time. I'm going to skip that just to tell you that we've implemented this in liquid state. It really does work. That's published too. What prevents us from doing this with the electron nuclear spin system? The challenge in the electron nuclear spin system is I told you that the nuclear spins need to have resolved hyperfine interactions in order for me to have universal control. So all of those nuclear spins need to be distinguishable. Yet, to have this noiseless subsystem, all of those nuclear spins need to be exactly the same property. And you say, hey, you can't have it both ways. But they say, sure I can, because I have my electron spin actuator sitting here. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to use the electron spin actuator to randomize the information over those nuclear spins. So I say, oh yes, the hyperfine interactions between the electron spin in one, electron spin two, electron spin three, those are all different. I'm going to take the information that I have in the nuclear spin manifold, I'm going to move it between all of those, either by a cyclic process, or I'll do it by a set of swap gates. It doesn't make any difference. And if I run this fast enough, then I will fall into this noiseless subsystem. And my information will be preserved. Okay? What's fast enough? I need to carry out this averaging fast compared to the electron T1. Well, the electron T1 is abysmally short. I mean, I've got nuclear T1s of hours to days, I've got electron T1 of 10 to 100 milliseconds, you know, it's abysmally short. But my control pulses are tens of nanoseconds to a microsecond. So you say, well, hold on. Actually, it's incredibly short compared to the nuclear spin T1, but it's very long compared to the control field. It only matters how long it is compared to the control field. And so we can do this quite well. And what we show here is the fidelity that of the information reserved as a function of the correlation time of the noise, effectively. And we can see that as we get out here and the noise correlation time becomes long enough that we can actually randomize everything quickly enough, we recover our fidelity. So we can do that. And I'm going to leave that. So here's the model back again. It says, I've got my local processor. I'm going to take the physical spins. We're going to map those into logical spins. OK, so that's the first thing. We're going to do that in parallel over all of these. And now I have some set of logical spins over all of these things. And then I can connect the logical spins. And then we can worry about what further error correction one would have to do. But at this point, we would have a pretty coherent system. And you would say, well, okay, how many spins does it take? Well, the code that we would like to implement is 9 spins to 5 logical qubits. Okay, so imagine our goal is to say that we have 5 logical qubits per node. Okay? That's a challenge. Okay, so we're back to the whole thing, and the piece I haven't told you about is right here. How do I read 1 electron spin? Not 2, not 10 to the 6, not 10 to the 11, but 1. 10 to the 11 is what you would get if you buy it from Bruker. We made really good systems. Okay, but well, we want 1. Okay, so the easy answer is there are lots of potential ways, and I don't know which one we're going to use yet. But let me tell you about 2 that we've been exploring in the lab, and let's have a look. So the first, which every experimentalist in quantum information processing is playing with today, is to look at the nitrogen vacancy defect in diamond. So you take diamond, you implant the nitrogen, you allow the nitrogen to float around until it finds a local vacancy. And when it does that, it has this nice structure that the ground state of the electron looks like it's a spin 1 electron system. So here, think about this as a spin 1 process. And when you excite it with green light, then it falls down through this excited, this E3 state. We excite it much higher than that. It falls down into the state. And there's an intersystem crossing. And forgetting all the words, the only thing that matters here is to say, look, if I'm in the zero, MS equals zero manifold of this electron spin 1, and I excite it up here, then it falls back down. Sorry, let's do that again. I'm in the spin 0. I excite it up here. It falls back down to the same MS equals 0. So this is a cycling transition. If I start off in MS equals 0, I excite it, it falls back down. And it emits a red photon when it does that. If I'm up here in the plus and minus 1 manifold, and I excite it up with green light, it falls down. Well, sometimes it will fall down and emit a red photon. And every once in a while, there will be this intersystem crossing where the system gets shelved over here in the A1 state. And for our purposes, it stays there forever. I mean, come on, this is a horribly long time, 300 nanoseconds. So it's just sitting over there, and of course, it can't emit any photons. Okay, so now then we say, oh yeah, if I'm looking at this system and I want to know, are you in the 0 or 1 state, I shine green light on it. And I look, and if I get back a bunch of red light, that was in the 0 state. If I get back a little bit of red light, then I was in the 1 state. Okay? And if I want to polarize it, it's very easy. Doesn't matter where I am. I just keep pumping it and pumping and pumping and pumping, and eventually I'll end up in the 0 state. Okay? So optically, I can polarize this. Now, this confocal microscope picture is a picture of a particular diamond sample. And each of these bright lights is 1 defect. And what we do is we focus in on 1 of those. And so when we're looking at these systems, we have 1 electron system that we're looking at. We're looking at it by itself. I should tell you, this is just the spectrum of one of those things. The 3 lines here says that there's a coupling to the nitrogen spin. The nitrogen is a spin 1 system, so you get 3 lines. So I want to show you that we can control the electron and a nearby nuclear spin, right? Because that's what we want to do for a model. We want to say that I have control, that I can control the electron spin in something close by it. And with Jonathan Hodges and Michel Lukin, we looked at a very simple experiment. We first initialized the electron spin and a nuclear spin in the down state. put the electron spin in any arbitrary state. So he created an arbitrary coherence of the electron spin. Then we correlated those two. So we're going to try to have a quantum non-demolition measurement. Okay, I'm going to try to make repeated measurements of the electron spin. Okay, I'm going to use the nuclear spin as a memory of the state of the electron spin. So if I want to use the nuclear spin as a memory, I better correlate it. Okay? So memory is a little bit of a bad term. I haven't copied or cloned anything, but it's correlated. It's a good state. We make a measurement. And remember what happens when we make a measurement, that we're making a measurement of the electron spin. And what do we get out? Well, at the end of the day, we get a photon or not. So we know whether we were in the zero state or the one state, depending upon this little burst of red light that we get out. But the electron spin always ends up in the zero state. At the end of the day, we always end up with the zero state of the electron spin. So we end up with this state. So we've lost our correlation. But that's okay, because I can apply a control NOT gate here that says flip the electron spin conditionally on the nuclear spin. That's a nice gate. And it takes us back up to here. Then I can measure this thing again. Get another little burst of red light, or not. And I can keep doing this. And we can do it one time. I don't remember the numbers, but we can do it 60 times without resetting. And we get about an order of magnitude increase in the polarization. So we have a small quantum system that we can control, that we can polarize, that can read out. Okay? It's not connected to the rest of our processor yet. But, hey, it really does work. I'm not going to skip this. I just want to tell you that if we take the same system and we say, well, how long is it coherent for? It's just coherent for more than a few milliseconds. Okay? So we can keep the coherence around for a long time. That's important. If the NV system is coherent for longer, then it can be sensitive to weaker things. And weaker things are our quantum computer, right? All right. So that's one piece of this. That's the ODMR piece. I'm not sure that ODMR is the right way, because it comes with a lot of baggage. And it's easy to have one spot. But it's very hard to have a confocal system where you have one confocal point and then 100 nanometers away, you have another one. Okay? So life is not so great if you want to have lots of these things. And if I only have one of these and I have a really long chain here, I'm going to run into trouble someday. Not for a long time, but we would. So another way of detecting magnetization is, of course, with superconductors. And so this is work that we've done recently with Will Oliver and Jonas Bylander, of looking at the dynamics of a persistent current flux qubit. So another device that just look at this loop. Forget about the crosses. The only thing that matters here is that it's a loop of wire, and it can be quantized with the current running clockwise or counterclockwise. Since you have a current flow, then certainly it's sensitive to magnetic fields. And it's wonderfully sensitive to magnetic fields, unfortunately, if we try to use it as a qubit, because we see all sorts of decoherence from that. This is the Hamiltonian that we're going to look at. It says, hey, I have a qubit with current going this way or current going this way. Okay, so it's a two-level system. Okay, so it's quantized along Z with an energy given by the energy split between current going clockwise and current going counterclockwise, two levels. This is about 5 gigahertz. Then there's lots and lots and lots and lots of noise. Over here, I have my drive field. My drive field says that, hey, I can couple magnetic field into this to influence how the current flows. So if I couple magnetic field into it, then, of course, the current wants to respond to that. That's what sigma x says. And it says, oh, I can have a DC bias, or I can have lots and lots and lots of noise. And the T1 of this device is 12 microseconds. The T2 is about 25 microseconds. This is, here we go, 23 microseconds. This shows the Rabi oscillations. This is driving the device from clockwise to counterclockwise to clockwise to counterclockwise. You can see we have good coherence in the device. And this is the characterization of the noise in this device. So what I've plotted here is the noise power versus the frequency of the noise. And I've plotted it for the computational basis here and here, and for sigma x noise up here, so the so-called flux noise. And this nice line here, that's our theory that says anything that fits on this line, well, this piece too, this piece, we know what's going on with. And so you can see that, well, down here at the high frequency noise, we only make an order of magnitude error. Over here, nature's kind to us and provides lots and lots of interesting noise to the system, which will give us chances to have many PhD theses trying to figure it out. But there's lots of noise. And it is incredibly sensitive to every little magnetic field fluctuation that goes on. And so the good news is it's incredibly sensitive to every little magnetic fluctuation that goes on. The bad news is that nature's already provided so many of these, it's going to be hard for the device to recognize our little spin in all of the stuff that nature provides. But we have pretty good coherence. We can engineer these. We can make these small. And this is a very promising, it doesn't sound like it maybe for my talk, but this is a very promising system because we get to engineer it any way we want. We get to build these devices. We don't have to take what nature gives us. We can make it into a piece that we like and control it. And sensitivity-wise, it is more sensitive than we need. So where are we? It says, okay, in one room of the lab, I can explore this. In another room of the lab, I can explore the error correction. I can explore this piece of it somewhere else. I can explore this piece of it somewhere else. And if you come over to my lab, you'll see that we haven't saved any room in the building for putting the whole thing together. But, someday in the future we'll get there. And we'll see that. Right now, we've got this piece working really well. I expect to have this piece working really well, and this piece works really well. Now, I still haven't told you how we're going to get the system with one molecule, right? A lot of what we do in this system is to look at a single crystal. So we're looking at 10 to 17 copies of something. And if this is going to work, what needs to happen is over here, we have sensitivity of one spin. Over here, this needs to be one electron. That needs to be one electron. This needs to be however many nuclear spins. The way we're going to build that is a fun toy called a Langmuir-Blodgett trough. So what Langmuir and Blodgett showed many, many years ago is that if you take a surfactant and you float it on water, you can form, and if you're careful about your chemistry, you can form a monolayer of material on the surface of water if you keep the water really, really still. And if I take a paddle and slowly compress that film, you can compress that film into a two-dimensional crystal. And what many people have shown is that if you take something as simple as a cover slip and you dip it into that solution, you can transfer that crystal that two-dimensional crystal as a monolayer onto the surface of that cover slip. So what we want to do is replace the cover slip with one of these diamond pieces and to plate out on that diamond a nice single crystal in two dimensions of our processor, and to have all of this structure built into the chemistry. That's one molecule. That is the next molecule in the crystal structure. So those things have been done. Not onto diamond, but diamond's a nice device. So it should work. We'll try it. So at RAC, what we're doing, we're saying, oh yeah, we're going to build, we have all these things working. We're going to carry out experiments to look at these different pieces of a quantum computer. And as we get them functional and perfected, we'll slowly try to put them together so that we can build up this toy model of a prototype quantum computer. The toy model of a prototype quantum computer will give us some things that we don't have today. It'll allow us to do parallel error correction. It'll allow us to do efficient transfers of information within the processor. It'll allow us to more efficiently than we can today remove entropy. And hopefully, from what we learn with those things, we'll be able to come with a yet more reasonable step towards a quantum computer. Quantum computers are a long way off, but quantum processors are not. And these are the people that are going to make it happen. Many of them are in the audience. The folks over here with some parentheses after their names are the ones that I've alluded to experiments they're working on. These people were ex-members of the group, or in the case of Jonas and Will, are people that we collaborate with at MIT. So let me stop there. Thank you, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
So first of all, we'll take questions from students in the audience. Are there any questions?
So, in order to do all of this, you need to cool down the system to really cold temperature, right?
So, not necessarily. If I use the optically detected magnetic resonance, we do that at room temperature.
Oh.
Now, if I use the squids, then we do it at 15 millidegree Kelvin. So, you know, somewhere between room temperature and 15 millidegree Kelvin will be operating.
Okay.
It doesn't worry me to say that thing should be cold. A quantum computer is such a complicated device that we need to throw a dilution refrigerator into the mix. It's an easy piece of technology compared to everything else.
Okay, so then questions generally?
So, do you need a lot of these electron spin? You have like classical bits,
yes,
specifying these, right? So as your system becomes bigger and bigger, you'll need more and more of those?
That's a really good question. And I'm hoping to find out. So I drew it with two classical bits because one of the models of computation is to say that I have an ABC processor. If you have a linear array of processors that you can label ABC, then you can do universal quantum computing. I'm not sure it's the way anyone would want to do universal quantum computing, but you know that would only cost us two. Beyond that, of course, you need more. But remember, I'm not suggesting that this is going to be the quantum computer. You know, it's going to give us some chance to explore things. The reason I put these classical bits here is I really want to turn on this magnetic field. You see a lot of proposals that use permanent magnets to create big magnetic field gradients for the control. They're noisy and
I don't want to have this processor different from that one when I'm applying error correction. I think that I'd rather go with the technical complexity of turning something on and off and give up a couple spins than to go with the control complexity of trying to do something in parallel, given that inhomogeneous interaction.
Question special.
Yeah, I may have missed it, but I didn't. Did you speak about how you were going to be pumping entropy out of this?
Right through here. Yeah. Yeah, so I can repeatedly measure the system. And you can see that what I need to do is I need to keep these electron spins polarized. So the challenge is to be able to keep these in their ground state during all the computation. At the moment, it all has to come through this that says, yep, I measure something. Or, you know, I don't even have to measure it. I just set this one to zero and reset that one to zero, right? Who cares if you measure it?
And so these ideas, I guess Talmore and those guys, like the algorithmic cooling, does that play any role in this?
It doesn't. Already, the purity of this spin is so high that I doubt I need to worry for a small processor about algorithmic cooling. You know, of course, if it was a big processor, one would have to. But for something that is small, I think that will be so close to having a unit polarization that it won't matter.
If you're planning to use a squid for the readout, isn't it much bigger than the size of the processor?
It is. So we're going to use not a squid, but we're going to use a persistent current qubit. Now that also is much bigger, but all I need is to have a small transformer that couples that to the spin of interest. And that can be very, very small. So you've seen, maybe you have, but scanning magnetic microscopes use these incredibly small sensors. So there's a bit of known technology that we can borrow to do that. But effectively, you're right. You say, okay, I've got some measurement device over here, which is horribly big. You know, it might be all of 10 microns. And I need to couple it over here to something that's as local as something that's a few nanometers.
So if you had many processors, would you use one squid or many different?
Many, you know, of these? At the moment, we'll use one. It would be nice to think about having two. I think that if we had one and, you know, we were saying that this was going to be a quantum computer, which I'm not saying, and that this was an infinite chain, you'd be in a lot of trouble, right? You need to have many ways of getting entropy out. You have to get out entropy free locally. But you know, we're a long way away from putting everything together. But I will say that yes, with the superconducting system, I can make this small. With the confocal system, I don't know how to make it small. Now, there may be some way. I'm not saying, you know, I don't know how. But with the other system, we can make it small. That's been done.
This is wonderful. Supposing that quantum mechanics is not quite right. For example, in a way in which if you have n spins together, they start to have nonlinear evolution or something like that.
Uh-huh.
How well will you be able to explore that while you try to build these devices?
Well, I hope very well. We have in the lab, in other systems, created coherences of hundreds of spins and looked at the evolution of that. And
everything's okay.
Well, you know, there's no errors that we see that we're that we're willing to associate with anyone besides ourselves. But you know, if there's a particular signature of an error that you could say, if you see this, then you know it's nature and not your own bungling work, then I'd love to hear about that.
Okay, let's finish there. Thank David once again.